All right, let's take up with our second hour. Just as a another housekeeping detail, the material is streaming live at the Buford site, and we'll send those links out later again for everybody who needs to watch it tomorrow. And then the material will be archived as well. So it's not being recorded directly through Zoom. It's being recorded through another app, and then those videos will be saved online as well as the audio. And so everything that you're seeing on the screen will be archived from the standpoint of the audio and the video, but also the actual materials, that is, the handouts will be presented. All right, so we went through all the basic stuff, so to speak, in the first hour. Want to start in the second hour, and there's a tremendous amount of material to cover here, and how far we go, well, that remains to be seen. And so what we ended with at the very end of our class was that the restoration begins essentially a do-over. So just keep this in mind from the standpoint of where we are historically. From the time of Moses and the departure from the land of Egypt and Mount Sinai, where the law was given, to the time that Saul, the tribe of Benjamin, became the first king, that's roughly a period of 450 to 500 years. So these are broad round numbers. We're not trying to be specific, but just to give us a time perspective. So Moses is roughly, and again, roughly 1,500 years prior to the time of Christ. That may fluctuate a little bit, but we're just going to use that as a rough figure. So until the first king comes on the scene, Saul, that's 450 to 500 years. From the time of Moses, Exodus, Sinai, law, to the fall of Israel, that's the northern kingdom where Samaria was the capital city, later to become a region, that's about 750 to 800 years. I want you to get a perspective of what we're dealing with from the standpoint of where this is in biblical history. From the time of Moses, Exodus, the law at Sinai, to the fall of Judah, that's what we're dealing with most specifically in Jerusalem. That's about 900 to 920 years. All right? Again, these are rough figures. So, Judah falls in about 606 BC. Moses is roughly 1,500 years BC. So you've got roughly 900 years there. From the time, and we're dating everything from Moses, because Moses is when the law kicks in. The covenant goes back to Abraham, yes. But the law that's going to become preeminent in the lives of Israel has been, and will be even more so going forward. We're timing everything from that. So I want us to see where we are in reference to where Israel was when they left Egypt, pivotal point in Israel's history. So the time they came to Sinai, they were there within the first 2 to 3 months, camped there for the duration of the first year. Beginning the second year, they finally leave. So that's a marking point that we're starting with. So from Moses, Exodus, Sinai, and the law to the fall of Judah and Jerusalem, that's about 900 to 920 years. Now, the next thing is where we're taking up in the beginning of this period of restoration and intertestamental period. From that time, Moses, Exodus, Sinai, and the giving of the law, to the decree that the Persian king Cyrus gives that starts this restoration that's going to lead into the intertestamental period. That's about 970 to 1,000 years. To the rebuilding of the temple itself is another 20 years. So it's like 1,020 years from the time of Moses at Sinai to the time of Cyrus decreeing the finishing of the temple. That's a millennium. That's 1,000 years. So we're in 2020. What's 1,000 years to us? We can't relate to what's going on in 1,020. All right. We know the big year about the conquering that went on in 1066. That's a millennium ago. And so there's 1,000 years that have elapsed from the children of Israel at Sinai to this period of time. Why are we bringing this up? Because it's a do-over. They are starting 1,000 years later what they first started 1,000 years earlier. And so it's not, last year or the year before. This is 1,000 years after the law was initially given that they are, in a sense, starting from scratch. There's the point for the better part of a millennium, all but 7 years of captivity and the building of the temple. For the better part of a millennium, the children of Israel are starting that much after they started. They're doing the same thing at Mount Sinai. So that gives you perspective. God's patient. why is God patient? You know, 1,000 years later, you're starting all over. Why would God want to do that? Because it relates to his saving plan. So the Jewish people lived under the Mosaic law in the temple, in the priestly system. Most of that time, at least 90% of that 1,000 years, minus the 70 years of captivity and the 40 years of wilderness. So here's the point. They're starting over 1,000 years after they started to do this stuff the first time at Moses at Mount Sinai. That's where the instructions are given for the Ten Commandments, the rest of the domestic laws about the priesthood, about business, relationship to families, relationship to foreigners, relationship in domestic affairs. All of those things are spelled out. They're starting all of this stuff 1,000 years after they first did it. That's just a big deal, 1,000 years later. So, what are the things that they're going to have to deal with is there's a whole lot of discouragement and despair there. Remember, Solomon's no king, not the king. There is no king. There's no beautiful temple. There's no beautiful city. You don't see all of those things that they used to have. They're starting over for nothing. So notice, no king, no temple, no world standing as a nation. One of the things that attracted the attention not just the temple, but also Solomon, was that people came all, you know the story of the Queen of Sheba. She came to hear about Solomon's wisdom. And people from all over the world were paying tribute to Solomon because of his wisdom, because of the empire that he's established. The kingdom spread during its greatest time, during David and Solomon, to its greatest reaches geographically. No more. That doesn't exist now. The other thing that's very critical, and we're going to see this especially as we're going forward, and so if I emphasize these things a little bit too much, when we get further into this, this is going to make a lot more sense. Most of the Jews aren't coming back. They're staying in Babylon, or they're already scattered in the nations. And more about that's going to come up. So they're decimated. Literally, decimated means a tenth. Well, how many Jews were there all over the world? We don't know. But they didn't all come back. So why did they still exist? Why is God keeping them alive? They have a purpose to fulfill, leading to Messiah. So this period, even though prophecy is going to end with Malachi, in the next few hundred years until the destruction of the temple, God's still doing stuff through the children of Israel from the standpoint of what they were to maintain in the temple system, the priesthood system, and especially as they're leading to the time of Christ. So we have a question. Why didn't the nation and the people just totally dissolve? Other nations did. Why did that not happen? Because God had a purpose for them. So God's got something he wants to do. And here's the point. God still had a purpose and a plan for the Gentiles, or for the Jews in Israel. Though scattered in large measure, still maintained, God still maintained much of their distinctive spiritual, ethnic, religious focus in the nations where they now found themselves. Just think of this. For nearly two decades, Joseph maintained his individual religious, spiritual identity, even when he was separate from his family.
Is this where the synagogues came into play?
Yes, and that's one of the things that's going to come in. And this is another thing that's very, very big dynamic when we get into the period of the New Testament. We mentioned before, there's no Sadducees, there's no Pharisees, there's no Sanhedrin, and the role of the priest takes on a new dimension during this period of time. And the place of the worshiping, synagogue, simply means a place of gathering together. So it was an assembly place. And so they couldn't assemble in the temple. This is going to come out later, but we'll mention it here. They couldn't assemble in the temple. Why? It didn't exist. And even if it did exist, they weren't where it used to be. For 20 years it stood after the beginning of captivity, but a lot of the people were taken away. 20 years into the captivity, Ezekiel has the dubious task of telling the children of Israel, it's gone. They were okay, some of them, with being in captivity because God still lived in the temple in Jerusalem. But he's not there anymore. We already mentioned that. God left the temple and the temple is destroyed. So something else is going to kick in, as Lyle made reference to, the period of the synagogue worship. So God still has a purpose. They're scattered. They still maintain something distinctive and unique that's going to be a representative of what God wants them to be. Just a reminder, if you read now the opening verses of Acts chapter 2, it talks about all the Jews who gathered on the day of Pentecost. Where did they come from? All those countries are countries to which the children of Israel in the north and in the south were scattered during the captivity in Assyria 722 and the captivity by Babylon. That's where the Jews were. They're scattered everywhere. And that's just the beginning of it.
That map, I've got a map that shows where all those places were.
Right.
That's pretty extensive.
Well, and when we get into the impact of Alexander the Great, which we may or may not get into this evening, you're going to see just how far flung the Jewish people were. And so God still had a purpose. Half a millennium after the restoration began, Jews were still doing what God wanted them to do. Now, how did that happen? You don't have the ongoing prophets. You don't have all the prophets, starting with Isaiah and the major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, Daniel. Jeremiah wrote both Lamentations and Jeremiah. You don't have, you know, all the minor prophets, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Micah. You don't have those 12 prophets continuing through the period of the restoration. And so they had to maintain these principles without a Moses, without a Joshua, without a David, without a Solomon, without any king. They're doing these things all on their own. Now, there's going to be a power vacuum that's going to be filled. And I want us to talk about that because this is going to impact what Jesus dealt with. Jesus dealt with the power that had become resident in the priestly system when he came on the scene. The priest had much more power during the days of Jesus, not because God gave them more power, because there were no kings. Because they didn't want to be under the impression of the Roman rulers and the procurators and the governors and the king Herod and his sons who took over different parts of the empire. And so the priest assumed a greater role during this period of time. And that's going to be critical from the standpoint of what we see when the New Testament starts. All right.
Isn't that why when the Romans invaded Israel, if I remember my history right, that it was more difficult to come into Israel than other places they invaded.
We'll talk about some of that as we go a little bit further. All right, so notice, so what are they going to do? They're reestablishing the temple worship. Remember, the temple is gone. To reestablish temple worship, you got to reestablish the temple. They have to reestablish, as we get into it, during the time of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, especially Ezra and Nehemiah, they have to reestablish the priesthood. Where was the priesthood all this time? In captivity with everybody else. What were they doing? They weren't doing what they used to do because they couldn't do it where they used to do it. Why? Not in Jerusalem, and the temple's not there anyway. And so the role of the priest takes on a new dimension in the period in captivity. And it's going to take on a similar but still new dimension when they get back into the land. So they have to reconnect with everything that they did before. They have to reconnect with ethical principles toward God, toward each other, meaning the non-Jews, and in every area of life. Everything that Deuteronomy said, the second giving of the law before they go into the land of Canaan, had to be repeated. All the laws that started in Exodus 20 with the Ten Commandments and all the domestic and civil and religious and business principles and things about health and diet and so forth, all that stuff starts all over again. So in effect, everything from Exodus 20 to the end of the book of Exodus about the whole system starting for the first time at Sinai, they have to go through it all over again. Only they don't have the same leadership and the same dynamic, and there's nowhere near as many people.
They sort of had to do that again when they left the wandering in the wilderness.
Yeah, well, the things that they started at Sinai had to be continued through the wilderness and then had to kick into full gear when they get into the land of Canaan.
I was reading in Joshua where some of the things they did once they came in.
All right, so what are the difficulties? All right, there is no king. Remember, let me correct this real fast. There is no king. Again, there's nobody to tell them what to do. There's no seed line. Jeremiah prophesied no descendant of David would rule again. That is, the seed line continued, but nobody's sitting on the throne. Solomonic temple's gone. The new temple has to be rebuilt, and now they have to start all over again. So, now, here's the outline that we mentioned before. We're going to drop down and start to the first major historical thing that happens. All right? So, the Jews are going to come back. This starts with the decree of Cyrus, roughly 535-536 BC. Now, when Cyrus gives a decree, he allows everybody to go back home, not just the Jews. Now, that's significant. Now, I don't want to read this verbatim, but I don't want to miss some of the key points. In the nation that conquered the northern kingdom, Assyria, they conquered nations, scattered people, and repopulated the places from whence they came with other peoples. So, Samaria, that was the city, is now a region. And Samaritans during the time of Jesus, this is another thing that develops at the close of the Old Testament and during the period between the Testaments, the Samaritans became a mixed race people. And the Jews didn't like them. Why? Because they weren't purebred Jews. They didn't like people in Galilee because Galilee was in Galilee of the North or Galilee of the Gentiles. The Decapolis, the 10 cities bearing a Greek name, was where a lot of the Gentiles lived. There were Jews there, but there was a higher concentration of Jews, faithful Jews, according to many of the religious leaders, in the south. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Why would they say that? Because Nazareth is in Galilee. All right? Aren't they all Galileans? All right? When Jesus was called a Samaritan one occasion, that was like a curse word. Well, he's a Samaritan. All right? He has a demon. He's beside himself, said Paul, and so forth. And so all of these things were said in a disparaging way. So when Assyria conquered nations, they scattered the peoples all over the place, and they brought peoples from all over there. So if they conquered 10 nations, they're going to take you and scatter you in 10 nations, and they're going to take people from all those other 10 nations and bring them here. So what does that do? There's no homogeneity of people anymore. You've got 10% of the people here, 10 here, and they're scattered all over. So there's no way they can be united. And so this is how the Assyrians function. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, is going to do the same sort of thing. And so here's the control that's lost in the Davidic seed line as you get closer to the time that they go into captivity. Jehoiakim's a king, and Nebuchadnezzar removes him as king. Where do you get the authority to do that? He's the dominant king. Is the dominant world empire. So he deposes Jehoiakim and makes Zedekiah king. How did that happen? Because Judah's no longer calling their own shots. All right? So here's a foreign king telling the southern kingdom of Judah what to do. Say, you can't be king. I'm going to make this guy king. Now, they're related. They're still in the Davidic seed line, but they're not functioning independently anymore. They become puppet kings. And one of the things that Zedekiah is a puppet king, and he would have not liked that, was he had to pay tribute. So you're conquered by another nation, you got to pay them. All right? That's going to come into play many times. So Zedekiah becomes king. At the same time that he swaps kings, he robs the temple of its treasure. So notice, the temple's still standing, but the temple is robbed. Now, in the history of the nation before, they had often borrowed resources from the temple and its treasury to buy off other people or to hire mercenaries. So the temple became like a free bank for many people to steal a lot of those goods to use for other purposes. So the Babylonian king robs the temple. Some of that's going to come back. They're later returned when Cyrus issues his decree. A lot of those things come back to the temple. Though Zedekiah was officially appointed king by Nebuchadnezzar, 11 years later he rebelled against him. And he wanted the Egyptians to be on his side and say, hey, will you be in league with us and help me fight against the Babylonians? Well, the Egyptians didn't do it. And so that was not a smart thing for Zedekiah to do. Jeremiah, if you look in the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah would often tell the children of Israel, listen, you're going to go to captivity. It would be better if you go easily and not resist. Because if you resist, somebody's going to die. All right? And so that was a policy. If you resist, you're going to die. If you fight against those people who are coming against you, it's not going to be good. And so some people fled to Egypt. More about that in the book of Jeremiah. And Zedekiah is going to resist. And so they don't yield. And that's not going to be good for him. So Zedekiah, the last reigning king in Judah, assumed that Egypt's going to help him. Didn't happen. Egypt withdrew, and Babylon, after a long siege, they laid siege to the city, during which time food runs out. And water runs out, and people are resorting to desperate measures to sustain themselves, all right? But eventually, they're going to defeat the city of Jerusalem. So why did they fall? The same reason why the northern kingdom fell. They weren't doing what God wanted them to do. They were involved in unfaithfulness, spiritually speaking, especially with reference to idolatry. And so idolatry has been a major issue going all the way back into the history of God's people. Just a reminder, Abraham was called to leave where his ancestors were on the other side of the river, according to Joshua 24, verse 1, because members of his immediate family were involved in idolatry. So they left. So that passage in Joshua 24, where God says, choose this day whom you're going to serve, earlier in the chapter, that's verse 15, he says, here's one of the reasons why Abraham left, is because his ancestors worshipped other gods. That's Joshua 24, verse 1. So there's a problem with worshiping other gods in the context of Israel's history going all the way back to the days of Abraham. So here's what's going on. You see the city of Babylon, the city of Jerusalem is besieged by the Babylonians. And Jeremiah the prophet tells him, he says, part of the reason why you're being besieged and why you're going to go into captivity is you haven't obeyed the law. And one of the specific things in this context was they held people hostage as slaves more than they were supposed to. They're supposed to release everybody. during the Sabbath years. And there was supposed to be a general proclamation of liberty during the year of Jubilee and so forth. But they didn't do that. And so Jeremiah tells us that one of the reasons why they were in captivity for 70 years was they didn't observe Sabbath laws. Think this. Sabbath year was once every 7 years. 70 times 7 would have been 490 years. And so 70 years of not keeping the Sabbath tells us for a half a millennium, the children of Israel didn't do what God wanted. So God says, time's up. That's enough. Book of Amos, the children of Israel were constantly called to be repentant. God said, I sent you famines, I sent you cleanness of teeth, I sent you all these things like I did after the manner of Egypt, but you didn't return to me. And finally he says, prepare to meet your God. And so in this context, Jeremiah gives them another opportunity. You release the slaves that you've kept way too long, and God will allow you to be free. And they said, we're going to do it. And then they gave in and said, nope, we're not. They backtracked. And so he says, okay. They're going to come through the walls, and that's exactly what happened. And when the Babylonians came through the walls, Zedekiah fled, and he was captured. His sons were killed in front of him, and then his eyes were, he was blinded. So the last thing he saw was the death of his sons, and he went into captivity blinded because he didn't listen to what God said. So Jerusalem fell. Lots of people were hurt. People were starved and so forth. Because of his rebellion, he's going to be captured. We just mentioned his sons were killed in front of him, and he was taken blinded into captivity. Now that's the beginning of what's going on. That's the end of what happens. But 20 years before that, they had already started taking people into captivity. So the Babylonians began to carry inhabitants into Babylon. Ezekiel, Daniel, two exilic prophets, they went into captivity before. All right. First carrying away was followed by two more. That should be deportations. Let me fix that real fast. I make mistakes, and if I don't correct them immediately, I'll forget. So as you read through what's mentioned in the text, that's the between the Testaments text, they were not so much in prison, but they couldn't just go wherever they wanted. They could wander around the country. They could build homes, they could have gardens and that sort of thing, but they couldn't leave. All right. So occasionally, for example, John was in exile on the Isle of Patmos. He wasn't in prison, but he couldn't leave where he was. So they're kind of like under house arrest, only the house is the whole country. And so you're in captivity in the country, but you can still go about business fairly much as you used to, only you're not in your homeland anymore. And not being in your homeland religiously for the Jews was meant that they couldn't keep what they had done prior to that with reference to temple worship. So they're removed from their homeland. So no real restrictions. They had to serve in some way, but there were sufficient freedoms that they could carry on most of what they did, but they're just not where they used to be. The biggest thing was this, they had no temple. And they couldn't be involved in the priestly system, the worship system that existed before, because they weren't where it used to be, and it's not there anymore anyway. All right? No access because they're no longer in Judah and because the temple had been destroyed. So their life is not just described as foreign, but they're described as living in a land that's defiled. Now that's interesting. They defiled the land where they lived, and now they are forced to live in another land that's defiled as a consequence. And so that's not just irony, that's comeuppance, so to speak. You defiled your own land, so I'm going to take you to a land that's defiled. You're not worshiping the right way, so I'm going to take you to a land where you can't worship me the right way, even if you want to. And so that's part of their punishment. Had no access in Judah, no access 20 years into captivity because it's destroyed the temple. Their life is described as being a life that's not just foreign, but defiled. We just mentioned that. They may have wanted to return, but they couldn't. Once the temple's destroyed, it's going to be another 50 years that the nation as a whole is going to remain in captivity. And that's just a reminder, 70 years, people are going to die there. People are going to be born there. And at least 2 to 3 generations are going to arise during this period of time who knew nothing about what they used to be. All right. So there's a huge turnover in population. There's a huge turnover in religious affiliation and connection with what they used to be. Remember, one of the things that's brought out in the context of the time at Sinai, when they institute some of the memorials, God says, you need to use these as an opportunity to teach your children and to teach your children's children and so forth. That's brought out repeatedly in Jeremiah. They failed to do that. It's brought out in the great three speeches that are given, great sermons that Moses gives in the book of Deuteronomy. You need to make sure you're teaching your children. Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy chapter 11. So now they have generations of people who grow up in a place where the teaching can't be the same because they're not where the teaching initially started. They are now in a different place under a different set of circumstances. So, what's going to happen? The option was only possible, that is, worshiping as God took place, if something major changed. And so they had to get out of Babylon, they had to get back to Jerusalem and Judea, and the whole system had to start over. That's why we mentioned before at the beginning of this is a huge do-over that's about to take place. So, the Babylonian kingdom is going to be defeated. The Medo-Persian Empire, it's a cooperative kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. Details about that are spelled out in some of the references to the materials that we cited. And then finally, the King of Cyrus, after the Babylonians are defeated, King Cyrus is going to release the people from Babylonian captivity. And so he's got a different idea. Rather than keep people in captivity away from their homeland, he's going to allow them to go back home. He thinks this is going to be better relationship with people. We'll let these people go back to where they came from. They won't be able to govern themselves. We're going to still have satraps and governors and so forth ruling over them, but you can go back home. You can do whatever you want to do. You can go back to your jobs, you can go back to your places, you can start your temples, you can start your worship, but we're still in control. So they allowed the people to go back, but they still had no king. And so they were still imprisoned, just in a different way, in a different place. All right, so they were imprisoned to sin, and they didn't worship God, and that's why God took them out of the country. God allowed them to be imprisoned in Babylon, so they couldn't just go wherever they wanted, because they were in exile there. And so when Cyrus becomes king, he allows them to go back home, but they're still in prison. They're still in a different kind of prison. They're back home, but they're not under their own thumb. And this continues to the time of Jesus. One of the things that was critical that's going on during the time of Jesus is the Jews couldn't stand that they weren't ruling their own house anymore. No kings. No kings since the time of Zedekiah that we just talked about.
So Herod, was he a Jew or a non-Jew?
He was an Idumean, which is an interesting thing. We'll talk about that when we get to that. And so, but that's an interesting thing. But I'm glad you brought that out. Herod was designated to be king by the Roman Senate.
Okay.
And one of the things that got his attention when Jesus was first born was when the wise men came to the city of Jerusalem, they said, "We are looking for he who was born king of the Jews." Herod wasn't born king of the Jews. He was made by a human government the king of the Jews.
That was Herod, right?
That's correct. To say that this child was born king of the Jews meant it was his by divine right, by birthright. And so the miraculous circumstances being guided there by a star and the stopping there, which is a fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy and so forth, that caught Herod's attention. Herod saw this child that he didn't even know anything about yet as a usurper because this child was by birth a king. Didn't have to wait to grow up to be a man to be designated king by the Roman Senate. He was inherently born to be the king of the Jews. And he knew that that would capture the attention of the Jewish people. And that's why it says all of Jerusalem is in an uproar. All right? So that's significant. Herod was a representative of a dominating nation, a domineering nation that ruled Israel. All right? Ruled the land of Palestine. Who was that? Herod did what Rome wanted to do. Why? Because Rome made him king. He didn't become a king because he conquered the land on his own. He didn't become a king because he subjugated other peoples. Somebody else who was in real control made him a king. And so that's what's going on. From the time of this point, at the end of the period of Judah standing alone, until the time of Jesus, and even beyond that, there was no king in Israel reigning. They were always under somebody else's thumb. And that was a sore spot for many of the Jews. And that's why there were always insurrections addressed in the context of Scripture. And that's why when Jesus came on the scene, they assumed he was going to be a particular kind of Messiah. He's going to be a military leader, he's going to be a political leader, and he's going to stomp everybody else on the ground. And the Jews are going to rise again. All right? They're going to be kings like David, kings like Solomon, and everybody else is going to bow down before us and pay tribute. But Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world." And in fact, Jesus, in order to be declared to be a Messiah, anointed the king, died. Now that's interesting. How do kings become kings? You got to be alive to become a king. Well, Jesus didn't become a king until after he died. What's that mean? It means it's a totally different kind of kingdom. And so that's incredible. So Cyrus is going to allow them to go back, all right? He's prophesied in the books in the book of Isaiah, and so he had a total different attitude towards the subjects. Rather than keeping people under his harsh thumb, that's the Assyrians, and forcing people and nations and people into exile all over, Cyrus allowed the people to go back home. Go back home. All right? You might say, well, he just lost their control over them. No. He still had governors all over the place. Satraps, they're referred to. All right? Governors of provinces and so forth. And he still ruled them. But you can go back home. You know, if the people are going to be happy because you allowed them to go back home and there's not going to be as much chance as rebellion and revolt and so forth, let them go home. But they still can't do what they want because we got our people there watching you. All right? And so it was easier to allow those people to go back home than to try to keep track of everybody there, and it made for better peace with the people. So that was a policy that he practiced. Well, that's a good thing because the Jews got to go back. So, the return's going to be a blessing, not going to be without its difficulties. Remember, 70 years they've been in captivity. Whole lot of things change in 70 years, all right? You know, if you're not 70 years old, just subtract where we are 70 years, go back, where's that going to take you? Well, you're back in the 40s, right at the end of World War II. Has the world changed since World War II? Yeah. How much did the world change then? In 70 years, a whole lot of stuff changed. Technological advances didn't come upon the scene, but world empires changed, peoples changed, practices changed, religions changed, borderlines of countries changed. I mean, that still happens today. You go back and you look at maps of Southeast Asia and different African countries, there are countries that have different names and different borders than they used to just within the last 50 to 60 years. This isn't a world in which there's that much more turmoil, and there are lots of changes that are going on politically, geographically, not to mention religiously. So, now, look, two successive captivities. First the Assyrian, that's the northern kingdom, and then second the Babylonian. The Jews, and this is what we talked about before, they're scattered everywhere. The Jews are scattered throughout the empire. During the time of the New Testament church, you're going to see they're scattered everywhere. We already alluded to Acts chapter 2. So what Babylonian Nebuchadnezzar did to Jerusalem repeated what the Assyrian kings did. They scattered people everywhere. And so this is in fulfillment of a prophecy that Moses spoke in the book of Deuteronomy. You're going to be scattered. So here's the prophecy of that in Deuteronomy 4 and other passages. So Cyrus allows the people to come back, but a lot of the people still stayed there. The book of Esther is a book that takes place not in the land of Israel. Why? Because these are some of the people who, after the period of captivity, didn't go home. All right? They didn't go home. And so here's a major biblical account of something that happens not in the land of Judea, not in Judah. So significant portions of people scattered through A&E, and incidentally the initials A&E stand for Ancient Near East. That's just the world in North Africa, the world in Italy, in Greece, in Macedonia, Rome, part of Asia Minor, the land of Palestine, Syria, Babylon, all that area. So you draw a circle around that, around the Mediterranean in large measure. That's referred to as the ancient Near East. So why are they scattered? First reason, God said through Moses, it's going to happen. If you're not faithful, God says, the land that I'm going to take you to will spew you out. If you're not faithful to me, I'll take you out of the land. And that's what's going to happen. All right? So it fulfills Moses' prophecy. Second, and this is incredible, when you get to the time of Paul in the New Testament, what was one of Paul's modus operandi in evangelism?
He always went to the synagogues first.
He would go to the largest city he could in the region where he was, and he would look for a marketplace or synagogue. He'd go there and begin to preach about scriptures, starting with Jesus, leading to how to become a Christian. And if he could, he'd stay there and strengthen them, or he would leave somebody else. And that's all over the book of Acts.
That's actually, if you look at Acts 1, what Jesus, before he ascends, says to do.
Yeah, he says the gospel's going to start in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the world.
Right.
Right. And so that's Acts chapter 1, verse 8. And the rest of the Acts follows that geographically.
It's like a...
And so that's a methodology. So the Jewish diaspora, which simply means the scattering of the seed or the scattering of the Jews, enabled the synagogues, we talked about that before, to start all over the place. And so now let's talk about this, the synagogue. No temple in Babylon. So how could they worship? They didn't have a place to go for the three great feasts, didn't have a place to offer the sacrifices and so forth. They couldn't do that. Now, we're going to get to it later. when the Jews come back from captivity, they're going to find some of the people who are still trying to do temple stuff without the temple. Some of them are offering sacrifice in and around the city of Jerusalem, but the temple's not really functioning there. We will later see that during the time of Jeremiah, some of the people fled to Egypt, and so many people fled to Egypt that they actually built the temple there and started worshiping in this Egyptian temple. But it's not the original one, and they're not doing everything that God wanted them to do in the way that God wanted them to do it. So during this period of time, the synagogue system of synagogues and synagogue worship, let me fix that, synagogue and synagogue worship are going to start. Cut off from the temple, the Jews continue to assemble to study scripture and to sing praise and God in smaller groups that eventually spread throughout the ancient Near East. And you're going to see this mentioned in the context of Ezekiel, and especially in Luke chapter 4, Jesus went to the synagogue in Nazareth, and it says, as his custom was. That's interesting. Why did Jesus do that? That's what Jews did. That's one of the things they did on the Sabbath day. They went there. And Paul, in Acts chapter 17, the opening verses, it says, as Paul's custom was, he went to the synagogue. Only he was going there to evangelize and teach about the Christ. Jesus was teaching and preaching and healing during his ministry, and he frequently used the synagogues to do that. And so that whole system, and that's a huge, huge discussion. There's a very pivotal academic book that looks like a coffee table book on the history of the synagogue. That's probably about this thick, and that's probably, you know, the size of the old Life and Look magazines. That's just filled with the history of the synagogue. So we're just saying it started then. But there's a whole lot more history, and some of that's listed in the bibliography. So in addition to no temple there, the priesthood, what did they do? Their whole service was focused on the temple. No temple. What are the priests doing? And so for 70 years, the priests don't have a place to do what the priests were supposed to do during the time that the law was being kept, at least in part, while they were in the land of Judah. So what are they supposed to do? What are they doing? They can't do the same stuff. And so we're going to see that the priesthood had to be reestablished. In order to be reestablished, you had to prove who you were. The high priest could only be descendants of Aaron. Had four sons. Nadab and Abihu died. Numbers chapter 10. Ithamar and Eleazar. So later, during the time of the period of restoration, they had to reestablish who they were and prove that they could be priests. Now, here's the significance of this. We mentioned this before. We're going to see it more coming into new material. The priests filled the power vacuum that was made possible by the absence of kings. The priests took on a whole lot bigger role in what was going on during this period of time in between the Testaments and when Jesus comes on the scene. And so the priest became a political hot potato. Why is Caiaphas and Annas both mentioned as high priests? Only one's supposed to serve at a time. And they're only supposed to serve one at a time for life. How can you have two guys being a high priest? Because they didn't do everything they're supposed to do. And it was a political and a financial thing. And that's part of the reason. We're not there yet. But one of the things that's going to happen is, remember, when they come back into the land, Sanballat and Tobiah, who are Samaritans, are going to challenge the right of Nehemiah and others to rebuild the temple, especially the walls later. And one of the things when Nehemiah was there twice, when he came back the second time, he found one of the priests, and his name escapes me, it'll hit me in a second, who was actually allowing one of the Samaritans, Tobiah, to live in the confines of the temple. And he wasn't a Jew. And he wasn't supposed to be there, and he used it like his own private, you know, storehouse and locker. And Nehemiah said, what are we doing here? You can't be doing this kind of stuff. Well, one of the things that's interesting is, during this period of time, the Persians did not allow people who worshipped according to their customs, those who were involved in the worship of that system, not just in Israel, but in other places, didn't have to pay tax. And so they didn't have to pay tribute in their own land or to the land to which they were obligated, under whose support and government they were. So they didn't have to pay taxes to anybody. And this is going to develop into a testy issue. The priesthood became wealthy because of the lack of taxation. And one of the things that we see during Nehemiah's time was some of the priests weren't paying all the Levites to do all the stuff they needed to do, and Nehemiah got up in arms about it. He says, you're not doing things that are right. They started cheating and cutting quarter on sacrifices, Malachi chapter 1, all in an effort to do what God wanted, but make some money on the side. All right? And so that's going to make priests a little bit more bigger for their britches than they needed to be. And Jesus has to deal with that when he comes on the scene. So everything that we're saying that's going to start now 400 plus years later, when Jesus comes on the scene, this stuff is entrenched. All right? What's one of the things that Jesus, and I'm jumping ahead, but I want to make a point. One of the things that Jesus says, he says, by keeping your traditions, you have made vain the commandments of God. Where did those traditions start from? Well, they have roots going all the way back to what they assume happened at Mount Sinai, but they're really going to catch on during this period of time. The priesthood is going to continue.
The rabbinical...
And I'm glad you... So the whole rabbinical system, let me mention this, and some of the material later is going to make reference to it, but let me mention it this part. When Ezra comes, he reads the text of the Bible in Nehemiah chapter 8 in Hebrew, but many of the priests have to go through the crowd and translate it for them into Aramaic. Why? Because during the period of time in which they were in captivity in Babylon, they don't know Hebrew like they used to. Ezra did, because Ezra was a priest. All right. So Ezra, prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord, to do it, to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. Ezra 7:10. So Ezra is schooled in this. So when he's speaking, others had to interpret for them. Why? Something was lost. So in 70 years, a lot happens. Language is lost. All right. All right. I'm an old guy. My mom spoke fluent German. Why? Because her mom came from Germany and her dad came from Switzerland. First generation kids that come from other places, moms and dads teach them all the language. All my aunts, three sisters, all spoke German. Guess what they did to the next generation?
They didn't teach them
like they did. Now, I know some, but nothing like my mom or my aunts. Why? As the generations go forward and they are removed from where they were, they're less likely to keep up the original language of their ancestors who immigrated from wherever they came.
You take a Star Trek term. They were assimilated.
That's a good point. No, that's a good point. So here's what's going on. That's the assimilation process in Babylon. They don't speak the language like they used to when they were in the land Judea and so forth. So they have to have those things translated. What's the point? That's another major change that takes place. All right? I had something else in mind, but it'll hit me later. So the priesthood has to do something else, because they couldn't do what they did do when they were in the land of Judah, because there's no temple there. All right, so this prompted Jews to do more things. Now watch all of these things that are going to develop. Prompted the Jews to emphasize other aspects of the Old Testament or First Testament obligations, leading to the development of religious sects. All right, you mentioned something about
the rabbis,
and I'm glad I looked at this. They'll make me remind me of it. They developed the idea. Now, notice this is an idea. There's no biblical merit to it. That at the same time God gave Moses stuff to write down, there were many things that were not written that later religious leaders, rabbis, recorded in writing that became just as binding as the stuff that God literally told Moses. And so the writings of the rabbis that Jesus often referred to, they assume they were just as legitimate as what Moses was told by God to write down. That's going to go on during this period of time. And a whole body of literature is going to be recorded during this period in between the Testaments that's going to influence the people that Jesus and Paul and others are going to try to teach. So you'll see I made reference to Aramaic. One of the things that they did was they translated a lot of the Hebrew into Aramaic, and they are called Targums. Targums are Hebrew translations brought into Aramaic, but with commentary. And those developed, they developed a sense of importance and authority that rivaled the Old Testament scriptures given by Moses. So you have, in effect, two competing systems of authority, both claiming divine inspiration, only one of which literally had divine inspiration. That's what came through Moses. So this stuff kicks into gear, allegedly going back to Moses. That's not true, but really kicks into gear during this. And so some of the writings that are extra-biblical, that developed in between the period of the Testaments, are going to be viewed by some of the religious leaders that Jesus deals with as having equal weight to what Moses said. And so watch what they would often do. They come to Jesus and ask him a question. They say, well, what can we do with reference to marriage and divorce? And Jesus would say something. They say, but Moses said. All right. So they say what Moses said, but they had their own slant on what Moses said. All right. And so Jesus, and there's the issue of tradition. All right. The word tradition literally means that's what's passed along. It can be good or it can be bad, depending on where it started. So they began traditions that started somewhere other than what Moses said, and it was embellished and grew over a period of time. So the rabbinical writings are a huge, huge history, and we're only going to touch on some of that. Now, what's interesting during this period of time, watch, because the priestly system was not in function at this time, there were lots of rules that were exaggerated. Sabbath rules are exaggerated. One of the things that Jesus gets into trouble for more often than not is doing something on the Sabbath day. Why? Because they made Sabbath laws into something that God never intended them to be. And that's brought out in Matthew 12, Matthew 15, all over the New Testament. Some of that's going to kick into higher gear during this period of time in between the Testaments. Now, the other thing that's going to become central is the role of circumcision. What does Paul often equate circumcision to? He equates it to making a law beyond the law that was a law that saved them by means of this simple physical act. That becomes accentuated this period of time. Why? There's no worship system that they're involved in. That was what God initially decreed. So they have to emphasize something else religiously. Now, these are oversimplified ways to describe this, but these things are going to become even bigger when Jesus comes on the scene. John had to deal with these things. Jesus had to deal with these things. Paul had to deal with these things. The Judaizing teachers that Paul had to deal with in the church were in part schooled in a lot of the teachings of the scribes, the priests, and the Levites in the period between the Testaments, assuming that there's rabbinical authority and it's equal to divine authority.
And yet in Acts 15, that's such a big issue.
It is. That's exactly right. And that's, and let me simply say, Peter capitulated on one occasion and played favorites to the Jews against the Gentiles, but he should have known better.
Right.
But that's an issue that they dealt with in Acts 15. But that's important. Some of the Judaizing teachers, what are they doing? They're binding law on Christians. Some of their emphasis on law is rooted in the emphasis of law that began, some of it, during this period between the Testaments.
So the attempt wasn't necessarily to be spiritually correct. It was an attempt to maintain control.
Well, but they assumed it was being spiritually correct because they assumed the authority they had based upon the tradition of the elders, which meant it go back to their ancestors, was equal to what was revealed by God through Moses. So they assumed it was the same. So, and I'm not going to pick on any religion. Pick a religion from A to Z. Pick whichever one. My guess is if you're something that's not part of the New Testament church or not part of a world religion, you're part of general Christianity, many, not all, but many of those people are going to rely upon some system of authority outside of the Bible. They're going to have a manual, they're going to have a creed, they're going to have a confession, they're going to have a council, they're going to have something. And some of those people will view those creeds, councils, confessions, and so forth on par with what God says in the Word. Some of them. You might say, well, this is just an aid to help us do that. Well, when you rely on the aid more than you do on the scriptures themselves, you've created a de facto sense of authority greater than what God gave you. That's part of what happens when Jesus comes on the scene in the New Testament. And some of that's rooted in this period in between the Testaments. Again, no prophets, no new scripture, no kings. The priests are going to assume a greater role than they had before. And so a whole system begins on its own in part. And this is oversimplified that's going to happen. So as you go through this, this is what's going to develop. So when the Jews get back, we mentioned this before, they see the 50-year-old devastation. The temple was destroyed 50 years. They come back and they see the temple's destroyed. The walls are gone. And what are we doing? And it wasn't even worth living in. The governor that ruled in that area didn't live anywhere near the temple. Why? Because it was in the city. Because it wasn't fit to be lived in. All right? So the Jews come back. Cyrus gives them the decree to rebuild the temple. On the arrival, they come back and they see there's some children of Israel who are there. So there are three deportations to Babylon, but some people are still there. And some people continue to do what they were supposed to do, only they made up their own set of rules as well. So watch this. Children of Israel taken into captivity in the north, scattered to the four winds. Children in Judah scattered, taken into captivity in Babylon, the whole synagogue system starts. Jeremiah talks about a whole group of Jews that go into Egypt, and they start their own system. The Samaritans start a temple about 150 years prior to the time of Christ, and they start their own religious system. And some of the Jews who are still in and around Jerusalem, they modify what's going on. So you got everybody's Jews doing all kinds of different things in Egypt, in Jerusalem, and around Jerusalem, in Samaria, some of those are partially Jews, and in Babylon, so you've got all these people claiming to do what's right. And so that's the kind of stuff that Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and had to fight as he come back to start everything all over again. It's not just a major do-over. It's a major do-over when everybody else says, we already been doing what's right. All right. So one of the things that that the religious leaders have to face is you've got people said, we've been worshiping God since the days of the prophets. Listen to us. Only they were doing it in the Samaritan way. And if you go back and look in 2 Kings 15 and following, the Samaritans did whatever they wanted to do. They all worshiped their own gods and claimed to worship the one true God at the same time. Yet they said, we want to be part of what you're doing in rebuilding the temple. And you know, Nehemiah said, nope, you can't. What do you mean we can't? We've been worshiping God, right? So everybody's making a claim to worshiping God, right? So it's not just a do-over. See, when Sinai started, there were no competing claims on the Jews to saying, we're worshiping God this way, because there wasn't a worship system yet. There wasn't the same worship system that starts at Sinai. 1,000 years later, you got lots of people claiming to do the right thing, only they weren't all doing the right thing. And remember, you've got a lot less people that are involved in this. So they all claim to be worshiping God. All over the place. So this is what's got to start. Here's my point. The period in between the Testaments is an incredible period because it starts off 1,000 years after what initially started at Sinai with nowhere near the fanfare, so to speak, nowhere near. God's not taking them to a new nation. He's not defeating all the nations. He's bringing them back to the land they lost because of their own sin. They didn't lose the land of Egypt to gain the land of Canaan. God saved them from the land of Egypt and allow them to defeat their enemies. Now, they're not defeating enemies. They are somebody else's enemy, and they're under their thumb. So it's a totally different perspective. All right. So this is a period of history that's unusual to study, first because a lot of it takes place outside of the biblical text. But it's still dealing with Bible people, who are supposed to be what God wants. All right. So these people remain. There's nothing that says they started. The people who were left behind, you've been here for 7 years while you rebuild the temple. Didn't have the resources. They were never given the divine mandate to do that.
It was the infirmed that were left behind.
As the people who were too old, too weak, or the poor, yeah, that weren't going to be able to do this. And that's one of the things that conquering nations did. They're going to leave anybody behind. They're going to leave people behind who aren't going to be able to fight against them. All right? So, you know, this is not speaking disparagingly of anybody's spiritual value, but these people don't have the wherewithal to do anything to take care of themselves, let alone to fight against us. So we'll leave them there. But the people that might cause problems, we're going to scatter them everywhere so they don't have the ability to regroup and strengthen. And so these people come back from Cyrus, and Cyrus says, build the temple. Who's Cyrus? All right? Now, what's interesting is Cyrus is not God, but Cyrus was prophesied by a prophet of God to be the one who is going to allow them to come back. So there's an indirect divine directive. Isaiah prophesied a man by the name of Cyrus is going to allow you to come back. So Cyrus didn't say, I'm a representative of the holy God. He allowed all people to go back to their lands and reestablish their system of worship. So these people are coming back saying, we're here because Cyrus is here. Who cares? Cyrus isn't God. We've always been here. And so there's going to be some tension. There's going to be some conflict there. I might just go a little bit more. We've gone 50 minutes in, so we want to take another break before our last hour. One of the primary objectives of the exiles, the prophets after the exile, that's Haggai and Zechariah, was to motivate the Jews to start rebuilding the temple. They started when they got back, but it took them 20 years to finish it. And mind you, this wasn't a temple on the scale of Solomon's temple. Why were they not getting it done faster? Because they ran into roadblocks along the way. People stopped them, people halted the process, and they didn't have the resources. So all of that's part of what's going to happen. So we're going to take up there. Let me just mention, I'm going to do this not to scare you, but all this material that I'm scrolling through real fast, I was hoping we'd get through in the next hour. And so my guess is we're going to be a little slower in tomorrow. But again, once we get past the issue of these people, when we get down to this, when we get into Herod, we're going to go through that part period rather quickly. All of this is background to what's going to happen next. And so if we grasp this, we can go a little bit more hurriedly when we get to the period of Alexander the Great, the Maccabeans, the Hasmoneans, and the Romans, because we're going to see stuff that happens now is going to have continual impact through these next generations of people who come in and take control. All right? Before we take a break, questions, comments? And for those who weren't here, who chose to go to the lesser class, I'm just kidding.
No. We feed
her. Everything is streamed, and so it's being streamed now, and everything that's being done is also going to be recorded, and I will send links out to everybody so you can have access to it later. All right? And all the handouts, like we've done before in the other classes, will all be archived online as well. And so if you haven't registered, get with Lyle to find out how to do that, and if we get your email address, everything, audio, video, all the handouts, and everything will all be accessible online after the fact. So if you missed something before, you can still benefit from what we've done. All right, so let's take a break for about 10 or 15 minutes, and we'll start our last hour. And just a reminder, this continues tomorrow night, same time, 6:30 to 9:30, and all day long Saturday, so bring your sleeping bags.
And lunch is provided.
Okay? All right, we'll take a break.